Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Chantal Lyon-Arthat. I'm the Associate Vice President of the Jennings Randolph Fellowship Program. This year, the Jennings Randolph Fellowship Program has started a new program, and that is an Afghanistan Fellowship Program. And in this program, we invite a number of outstanding policymakers and scholars to be in residence here in USIP for a number of months. And the program was extremely fortunate to have Massoum Stanikzai as our first fellow in this program. His bio has been distributed, so I won't go into details. Let me just say that Massoum Stanikzai is a policy advisor to the Afghan President Karzai. He has had particular responsibilities for demobilization and reintegration issues. And on a more personal note, I would say that Massoum is one of those rare fellows who can really bridge the policy and scholarly divides. And Massoum, we have greatly benefited from your expertise and your insights here at USIP, and I would like to thank you on behalf of the Institute for that. And we hope you will come back to us very soon. Massoum will lay out his policy recommendations of what we have to do in Afghanistan, how to deal with the insurgency. His special report on which his talk is based will be coming out soon, and those of you who want to make sure that you get a copy of this report, make sure that we have your coordinates. Massoum Stanikzai will talk for approximately 15 minutes. And then we've asked two of our in-house Afghanistan experts to sort of launch our discussion here, Alex Steer and John Dempsey. Alex Steer is a senior advisor to the Rule of Law program at USIP. He's also the director of a newly launched USIP program on the future of Afghanistan. Alex also has a new publication out, a USIP peace brief, that deals with the civilian casualties in Afghanistan, and you can access his brief on the USIP website. John Dempsey is also part of the Rule of Law program, and we are very happy to have him here because John is normally not in Washington, D.C. He's actually heading up our office in Kabul, where he leads the USIP efforts. So without further ado, Massoum, the floor is yours, and we look forward to your talk.
Thank you very much, Chantal, for the introduction, and thanks for everybody coming and joining us today in this event, and my particular thanks for the USIP for providing us this opportunity to be here and giving us some space for thinking, at least after being for so many years since the Bonn Agreement, dealing with the day-to-day work. And sometimes you need a space to sit and reflect and think that what is ongoing there back in the country, and to have some kind of a reflection what actually can be done or cannot be done in Afghanistan. I will be very brief, and I hope that the special report will come out soon, and then everybody will have the more detail of that, and the time will not allow that I should go through all the details, so I will focus on very few key areas that is reflected in this report. I will be very much preferring that we have a more live debate and discussion in the question and answer, because in that we will have more interactive discussion about the policy issues about Afghanistan. I will be briefly touching upon five key points. First, about the challenges and opportunities in Afghanistan. What are really the challenge and opportunity? Although everybody knows that about the long list of the challenges and the short list of the opportunities that exist in about Afghanistan. I will also a little bit discuss about the nature of the conflict in Afghanistan, the role of Islam and ethnicity in Afghanistan, and then I will talk about the whether we are facing with insurgency, with the network of the terrorists, with whom we are facing, and how we should deal with them. And one of the major discussion these days about Afghanistan is that, yes, military is not the only solution. Security is the top priority. The casualty is increasing. The concern is very high. So then what we have to do? So I will come with some few recommendations and with a framework that how ineffective reconciliation program can be launched in Afghanistan or to improve their current ad hoc initiative that is ongoing in Afghanistan. Coming to the challenges, I think from the day one when and I'm glad that Minister Jalali, the minister, former Minister of Interior, is here today among us, that from the day one we were facing with the kind of a security challenges. It was always the priority. But if you only look to the Security Council report that is regularly provided by their UNAMA office from Kabul, you will see that from 2002 up to today, the nature of the security challenges was changing, and always our reaction to the security challenges was reactive. We were not proactive to address the problem in an effective way. And the security challenges are not only related to the issue of insurgency. There are other issues that that impact the insecurity in Afghanistan. There is drug, there is the militia, there are the weapons everywhere in the country. There are criminality and there are poverty in Afghanistan. That all combining, creating a situation of insecurity in Afghanistan. In short, if you look to the challenges in Afghanistan, you can summarize them in three main challenges. You need to address the physical security, that the people are secure, and then you need the job, and you need the justice. Unless there is a justice in jobs, it is very extremely difficult to have a proper security. And then the other issues can be built around those issues. If you look to the security incident trends, it shows that we had a better window of opportunity in the beginning. In 2002, 3, and 4, we could do more at that time. But as the time went on, the insurgency regrouped. They become more organized. They find more resources, more recruit. And in that case, the situation, if you look to that graph, it was there before. It showed the security incident. If you go back to the graph, the other one. Anyway, there is a direct link between insecurity and increase of the poppy as well. Or the poppy increase, it is a direct link with the insecurity. As the insecurity increased, the poppy cultivation increased. As the poppy cultivation increased, so this is a kind of a vicious circle that we are dealing with in Afghanistan. At the same time, this complexity of situation in Afghanistan highlights that it is not the insurgency in Afghanistan is simply not just the Taliban. It is a very complicated regional situation in the country. And to deal with those kind of a complex situation, you have to come up with a more comprehensive approach to deal with those kind of a complex situation. And I will go to a little bit of more detail later on, so I will skip it right now. And I said that the governance, the corruption, the issue of narcotic, they are really the challenges. But apart from that, as far as the insurgency has their bases in safe haven, if they are secure in areas where nobody can touch them and they can operate from the cross border, there will be no security in Afghanistan and there will be no stability in Afghanistan. That is something that we have to understand, that that create the substantial problem or the core problem of insecurity in Afghanistan. We can talk a lot about the challenges, but let's focus a little bit about the opportunity as well, because these days many people don't want to hear about opportunities in Afghanistan because everybody says this. It is too difficult. It is very challenging. And if somebody talk about the opportunity, they will say, no, forget about it. We have to see the challenges. But what I'm seeing from the key opportunities in Afghanistan that are still there, I think the in area where we had made proper investment in building an institutional capacity, we made some good progress. In areas where there is the gap is bridged between the policy and implementation to deliver on the ground, we had made the progress. If you look to that different sector, why National Army is doing better, the police is not doing better? why there is a better program of delivery in the rural development and there is not in agriculture. Why health is doing better, why education is doing better, and there is a lot of achievement in those areas. It means that there are a tool and mechanism, they translated the policy into the implementation mechanism. And that is the existence of the national priority programs. Anywhere where you had those tools, there are progress and there are delivery. And it depends on the leadership and it depends on the way those programs are designed, supported, and helped. That is one area. And this is why I'm saying that today we are saying that NA is doing better. This is an institution and a potential that can, in future, can take more responsibility in terms of security, and I will come with specific recommendation on that as well. The other area is all countries in the region are suffering equally from the insecurity in Afghanistan. If today they don't realize, tomorrow they will realize about that. And there are common traits that will make it possible to build a kind of a regional consensus. Without having a regional approach towards security in Afghanistan, it will be, again, extremely difficult to build stability in Afghanistan. For example, the strength of the Al-Qaeda, it is a danger for Uzbekistan because the Namangani group is there and they are fearing they have the direct link with the Al-Qaeda. If you look to the to Russia, Chechen fighters are there, and they are part of the Al Qaeda network. If you look to the China, then the Uyghur Muslim groups are also part of the Al Qaeda groups. They are operating there. If you look to the issue of Iran, again you will find a threat because even these days the Al Qaeda want to consolidate their power at the Fatah region and root out the Shia groups, and again those are the kind of a problem that exists there. So there are potential and possibility that to build regional consensus around the common security interest, but we need a different approach to that. In 2004, when there was a conference in Berlin, then many experts believed that Afghanistan will be secure if Afghanistan could make an annual growth rate of 9%. Actually, Afghanistan achieved that target, and it shows that something is happening on the economic side as well, and there are some changes, but they are not enough, and they are not the only way that we can make Afghanistan stable. They need some other things. But these are some of the major issues that there are progress, there are hopes, and there are things that can be done differently. If you look, I will come now a little bit to say that how we can frame our final recommendations. Then we have to understand that the nature of the conflict in Afghanistan. I think the conflict in Afghanistan can be divided into two categories. One, there is at the regional and national level, and the second, it is at the local level. At the national level, it is more on the political level, and at the regional level, it has a root in the history. There is a dispute between Afghanistan and Pakistan on the Durand line. There is a dispute between Pakistan and India on the Kashmir line, and there are the water issues, and these are the issues at the background. And those background issue causes a different policy approach towards stability in Afghanistan. Some people see a stable Afghanistan for their benefit, and others see a weak Afghanistan for their benefit. So that is the kind of a different policy approaches towards the conflict in Afghanistan, and that fuel the situation. Second, Afghanistan is the legacy of 30 years of war, and there were different policy, and when you adopt a policy 10 years down the line, and then you will see the consequences afterwards. What we are doing today, we will see the consequences maybe after 10 or 15 years. And what has happened during the Cold War, we are seeing some of the consequences today in the region because of the ignorance, because of the abandonment of Afghanistan in the hand of the spoilers, and the creation of different illicit power structure outside the state power. So we had different bases of their strength in economy and their competition for power, and that also fueled the conflict. The other part of the conflict is at local level. That is natural. In any country, you will see those kind of a conflict. We have on the land, on the pasturages, on the natural resources, in terms of the different ethnic groups. And then there are the spoilers. In the spoilers, for instance, in order to reach to the resources, they will use ethnicity as a mean to achieve those goals when there is no other mean for that. So this is, I will not go through the details. The report will say all the details about the specific of all these details. So I will leave it here. So those are the main areas of the conflict in Afghanistan.
Masoud, can you hold your fire just for a minute? We have some overflow here, and I think we can open up in the back a bit. Chris, is that right?
I should stop.
Yeah, just stop 1 minute, okay. And I think it will only take them 30 seconds, but that will allow people who are standing in the room next door to be able to be seated. Maybe it brings in some fresh air. There we go.
Yes, well done.
So I should go on.
Thank you, Chris.
As I mentioned, there are various reasons for the sources of conflict in Afghanistan, and each should be analyzed separately in order to devise an appropriate policy for Afghanistan. So we have to understand better Afghanistan before we make any policy decision in Afghanistan, and this is one why I put this issue in this special report. The second issue is the role of Islam in the Afghan society. There is no doubt that Afghanistan is 98% the Muslim, and they are it has a significant role in the day-to-day life of every Afghan, but there should be a distinction. Traditionally, Afghan are moderate Muslim. They believe on Islam in from the depth of their heart. Anything that is against their perception, against Islam, it will be somehow reacted very furiously against that. But at the same time, Afghans are not extremists. The general population of Afghanistan is not that extremist. And this is the reason for the first time the Afghan people has welcomed the international forces in Afghanistan against the Taliban, because they were the one who were implementing those rigid policies in Afghanistan, even in the rural areas or in the urban areas. In Islam in Afghanistan, sometimes it is very much mixed with the culture and traditions. And sometimes for many people, it will be extremely difficult to differentiate between what is the cultural aspect and what is the basic philosophy of Islam. And that makes sometimes difficult for so many people to understand the dynamics that how Islam can be used effectively for as a unifying factor rather than to be used as a factor for violence. So this is why I'm saying that Islam can be used for more for the reconciliation, can be used more for unification, for forgiveness, and it needs a more kind of investment that how you can strengthen that kind of a perception within the Afghan society, rather than that to allow the extremists to invest more, to radicalize the younger generation and to make it, anyhow, it will have an impact. And it had an impact from the past, because during the jihad time, slowly a generation was radicalized, and that generation will continue for so many years to come. We have to invest heavily in education in order to change the perception and the understanding of the society that how best they can tolerate and live in coexistence. So that is an important issue, and we have to think about that. As I said, that the ethnicity had a role in the conflict in Afghanistan, but mostly, apart from this, that there are disparities. If there is equal opportunity for all ethnic groups, if there is the rule of law, if there is this equal opportunity, I don't think that the ethnicity will be a major issue for the continuation of conflict. But if there is disparities continues, if the political spoilers are still continuing to use the ethnicity as a mean or a source of reaching to the material and political power, then it will be an issue. And even the studies in other countries also showed that there is no direct link between ethnicity and the conflict. There are countries with the different ethnic groups, but they are living in coexistence and peaceful. There are unified ethnic societies where there are conflicts among them, but it needs a kind of a different approach. One of the things I should highlight here is one of the reasons that why the ethnicity became an issue in Afghanistan and fueled during the civil war, that was the kind of a formation of political parties in Afghanistan. 7 parties was formed in Pakistan, 8 parties was formed in Iran during the jihad time. There were communist or the leftist party, and most of these parties, instead of following the ideology and the mandate of the party, most of them were centered around the individual, about the leaders, from where these leaders came, to which ethnic group they belong, what was their close circle of the party leadership, and that created that impression and perception that, yes, this party is belonging to this or that party. And today, after the political party law was passed, we have registered more than 105 political parties, and most follow the same pattern. And you cannot see a kind of a national movement that they can see that, yes, this is the national interest of the country. We can mobilize the people against a national, around a national agenda. And without investing heavily as a political party system, again, it will be difficult to have a real democracy in Afghanistan. So I talked about that. Yes, we have the security challenges in Afghanistan. We need to find ways for how to stabilize Afghanistan. And one of the issues that was discussed in ad hoc basis and in a different on and off basis was the reconciliation, how to engage all the Afghans, how to bring the disenfranchised communities to support the government, the insurgency, and all of these. To understand that dynamics, I think you all know that even when the Bonn talks were ongoing, there was a discussion between the President Karzai was negotiating with the Taliban to surrender in Kandahar. And that was the first successful effort that they surrendered, and it means that the reconciliation was possible at that point. And after that, there was a number of efforts were made in order to promote the reconciliation, the lawyer jirga, the constitutional jirga, the election, they accommodated a number of the members of the Taliban or the other insurgent groups to join with the system and become part of the system. But there was no coherent approach to follow that in a systematic way. In part of the country, their war on terror was ongoing to hunt the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in searching the houses and to deal with those kind of a problem. In the other part of the country, we were dealing with the illegal armed groups, with a separate power bases. So it means we were not able to follow a very structured way how to accommodate those people who were very easy to accommodate at that time, because the only incentive they needed and wanted for reconciliation was that to give them amnesty, to give them some kind of safety and security. But later on, when they regrouped, it became more difficult because you were not in a position to go to provide them that kind of a guarantee anymore. The other big problem that was associated was because there are too many different partners and different actors are involved in reconciliation and political and reconstruction efforts in Afghanistan. One is giving one message and the other is giving the other message. if the Afghan government is saying that yes, we will invite everybody to be part of the deconciliation program, and we will talk with everybody. But the other day, for instance, the UN will say that no, we cannot talk with this category, and we should talk on that. Before going to that kind of a public announcement, the better way will be that to coordinate these activities and then come with a unified voice. Without having that kind of a unified voice, I think no reconciliation effort will have any credibility. Again, in this issue of outreach and reconciliation, there are, as I mentioned, there are too many actors. There are the government agencies. Different government agencies are involved. There is Ministry of Interior, Ministry of Defense. There are NDAs. There are, for instance, the Office of Security Advisor of the President. There are, for example, the Peace and Reconciliation Commission. So everybody has somehow an engagement. You have the international security forces present in Afghanistan. There are 47 countries contributing troops to Afghanistan, and each has their own small intelligence cell or group of outreach. The PRT is doing the kind of outreach there. So you can see that this is this represents a kind of opportunity of diversity of capacities and potential and resources. On the other side, it represents a kind of a chaos. So it means that how you can bring all of them together that to follow a kind of a structure approach or policy. So I'm nearly finished. The other important issue with whom we are talking, who are the opposition? And there are very confusing messages in different areas that who are the Taliban, how we can negotiate, whether they are negotiable or not, how we can reach them. These are sort of a different questions that in many different discussions and debates we are talking about it. I think if you look to the general structure, you have the Afghan Taliban. Some people call them the new Taliban. Who are these new Taliban or the Afghan Taliban? They are the remnants of the previous movement of that Taliban who fled Afghanistan, and they find their bases and support in the tribal area in the other side of the border. They reorganized. They were helped by the Al-Qaeda to regroup, and they started to recruit the new young madrasa recruit from the different part of inside Afghanistan, and mostly from the tribal area. At the same time, they changed their policy. They are using a free market approach to their operation to make them more bold. And that is, there are too many criminals inside Afghanistan, and they will contract them for doing a mission in here and there, a bombing, a roadside bombing, or an attack on a target, and they will be paid, and then they will announce that yes, we have done it, to make their case more in terms of their strategic communication. They are very much sophisticated. So that is one specific core group of the Taliban. The second, we have the Hizb-e Islami, which was a previous Mujahideen group and led by Gulbuddin Hikmatyar, and his people. He was not able to recruit new recruits, but he has the old loyal people with him, and they are more active in some part of the Kunar and some other part of the of Afghanistan. But at the same time, there is a lot of potential of that. Many of them are now part of the government, and they are in the parliament, they are in the government senior position as well. So it means there are possibility with whom you can talk, and some of these people, you can separate them from the insurgency and bring them into the mainstream politics. There are criminals and illegal armed groups. That network become very much sophisticated. Sometimes you cannot differentiate who is a drug lord, who is a criminal, and who is a Taliban. They are working sometimes in collaboration with each other to serve the purpose of the same purpose. And basically, when in USIP, usually people are calling the illicit power structure. And this illicit power structure really creates a problem for the state building in Afghanistan. The other part is the Haqqani group. Haqqani was also a former Mujahideen commander. He was supported by the Arab and also by the U.S. at the time of the jihad during the Cold War. He is very experienced, and he is from a tribe in the Paktia province. His son is now more active, Siraj Haqqani, and they were able to make a kind of a bridge between the elements in the Pakistan who support the Taliban, between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. He has the kind of a break between the different element of the insurgency who are operating against Afghanistan. And then we have the Tehrik-e-Taliban in Pakistan. And actually, the Tehrik-e-Taliban in Pakistan, and you know about this, they have the shuras in Kandahar, they have a shura in Quetta, there are a lot of discussion about that there are some differences between these two shuras. The son of Sirajuddin Haqqani, if you read, few weeks ago, he said that many of the commanders who were Taliban commanders who were killed by the coalition and U.S. forces was because of the mismanagement and poor leadership of the Quetta Shura. They should be dissolved. So there are some discussion, but they are not very much a serious issue that you can say that, yes, this is the breakthrough, the line of the insurgency there. You have that. Tehrik-e-Taliban in Pakistan, I think they are a syndicate of more than 22 groups. They are operating in the Fatah region. And you know the Fatah region is particularly, they are based in north-south Waziristan, and they are in Bajawul Dir and other areas. They are operating there. And most of these groups were formed in the 90s, and particularly when there was a dispute between India and Pakistan, and like the Jahish, like the so many different groups. And they've now come together and formed a shura of 40 people and led by Masood, who is now the senior commander for them. And Al-Qaeda is at the center. And actually, they were able to organize, for instance, they have now a country with no name. For a long time, there was a denial that there was there will be pure Al-Qaeda. But as you may know that the day before yesterday, there was a report somehow released and provided by the ISI to the Prime Minister Gailani that there are more than 10,000 foreign fighters in the tribal areas. And you know that fighting insurgency with that number of people and the flow of resources and cash, it will be very extremely difficult. With a conventional warfare, it will be extremely difficult to fight them. So there are they. So in the center, Al-Qaeda, in fact, provided a safety for them from the backward to fight the Pakistan security forces. So they have the Taliban, Pakistan Taliban, they can prevent them and they can provide security. On the Afghanistan front, the Afghan Taliban will provide them, but they are operating in mix. So with this kind of a situation, this is the area where this insurgency is more active. In the Afghanistan side of the border, we have more than 13 provinces, 82 districts, where they are bordered with Pakistan. But out of that, in 18 districts, there are more insurgency operation is more active, and their presence is more dominant. On the Pakistan side, there are seven agencies and six frontier areas. And it form around 2.6% of the Pakistan overall land. So that is the area generally the border between two countries these groups are operating. And it's very mountainous, it is isolated, and it is poor. And the economy on both sides is very much poor, and there is, and for a very long time, in the way they are administered, it is totally different than mainstream administration of the Pakistan, because Fatah has a different, under different regulation and different law, and that is from the British colonial time that they are ruled still under that law. So under such a circumstances, what we can do actually, and let me to conclude by saying yes, a few points. First, there is really challenges, but these challenges are not, and there are possibility to address these challenges. If we cannot address them, then we will lose the hope. Then why we are talking about Afghanistan? So I'm saying that there are challenges, there are difficult, but it is possible to address these challenges. The second, we will not be succeeding only by using the military means. We have to use a comprehensive and integrated approach toward addressing these challenges. Looking to the complexity of the situation and the difficulty associated with it, my main recommendation would be two set of recommendations. First, we need a framework for reconciliation in order to bring the different ad hoc basis approaches into a coherent program for the reconciliation outreach and bringing Afghan to be more actively engaged in the security and peace building in Afghanistan. And the main goal of this reconciliation program should be to break this vicious circle and to bring those who are engaged in the violence and political violence into a peace process. First, the reconciliation should be targeted at three levels: at the political level, and regional level. And at the regional level, we have to build a consensus. We have to have a regional policy, and we have to find a way to end the sanctuary of the leadership of Taliban and support bases from there. Otherwise, we will not have any success in any efforts of reconciliation as well. The second level is to target the mid-level commanders who are operating inside Afghanistan. The people know them, and to provide them with some kind of a boat to reach them, and at the same time to provide them with some kind of a reintegration package and engagement and opportunity that they become part of the normal. They can live normally as the other Afghan citizens under the constitution of Afghanistan. And the third level is we have to see the initiative and support the initiative at the community level, because there are many good examples that the community pressure has built some good momentum in peace building process. One of the examples, in the disarmament of the commanders in the current disbandment of illegal armed groups, we use the district councils and the district and the village councils to put pressure on the commanders to hand over their weapons, and then they will receive more development aid in their area. And actually, that worked very effectively. There are, for instance, the NSP program, which is now expanding nearly through all the country, and they were able to deliver the development project through the community mechanism, and they were able to provide security, they were able to provide governance and oversight. So using those kind of a mechanism, it will be very much effective. We have to use the mullahs, because they have their say is very much important, and we have to mobilize them that to use Islam as a way of promoting the peace and reconciliation. So that the different group of the civil society, the traders, the investors, and other intellectual groups and communities together will make a difference, but they have to be linked with the political level. If they are not linked with that, any separate initiative standing alone will not generate the result, because it will disappear, because they will not sustain it and they will not be able to keep it, because another stronger one will come in and will destroy whatever they have done. So first, we have to focus on the three level, not on only in one level. The second, we have to come with some kind of agreed principle of engagement, because who is doing what, they should know each other. We should have a common point of a contact. We have to agree that with whom we are doing the reconciliation, it should be under the Afghan lead. It should be in accordance to the Afghan constitution. And then there should be a recognition that those who are reconciled, they should not be intimidated in a way that they would say, oh, I have made a mistake, why I have come here. So there should be the right for the reconciliation, there should be the right for the follow-up and monitoring that who is really in this side. So there are a long list of how to agree on a certain principle of engagement, so everybody will know that these are the agreed terms through which we will be engaged in the reconciliation process. And without that, it will be extremely difficult. Even if we give the different messages, then that will destroy the whole process. The third issue in the reconciliation in this framework is we have to, what will be the element of this reconciliation program? We have to define that. What are these elements? I think there are seven elements for that. The first is that we have to be engaged in an active diplomacy. Active diplomacy is not only inside Afghanistan, but at the regional level. To build this regional consensus, to bring Afghanistan, Pakistan, India together on the same table of the discussion, because there are perceived kind of a concern between the different countries that they say that, yes, Afghanistan will be used against this or that, or and that will be, my advice would be, or my recommendation would be that the U.S., NATO, and others, and U.N. should be actively engaged to enforce their resolution, and at the same time, they have to engage them in an active kind of a dialogue in order to end this century and to work together and to follow the peace jirgah decision of the last between Pakistan and Afghanistan. Without that, I don't think we will reach to anywhere. We have to reach to those individuals who are engaged in the violence against the government. But there should be a common point or focal point through which all activity can be coordinated. We have to strengthen the local capacity for the outreach, because one of the biggest problems is the capacity of the local governance. If we don't strengthen that capacity, everything cannot be done from the center, everything cannot be done by the international. So the best way would be to strengthen the local capacity so that there is the gap between the local governance and also the community is reduced, and that will bring them, provide them with the opportunity to promote the reconciliation. So I will not go to more detail of this. I think we need to engage in a very active public outreach. We need a strategic communication. We need a reintegration package for those who will be reintegrated or coming back. And we have to build the community initiative and support them to be actively engaged. So that needs a coherent program. And the next step for that will be to design a program based on the framework to detail all the steps and approaches that in the labor division and the kind of a work that everybody should do. The second, it will be very wise to have an advisory team of experts and diplomats, both national and Afghan, who are experienced in these areas, and they can advise how best such a program can be devised and planned. Strengthening the current Peace and Reconciliation Commission and reorganizing that commission, because with the current the current formation, it will not be able to deliver what is expected. So it needs further strengthening, support, reorganization, at the same time, we have to also emphasize on the PRTs, the way they are operating. They have to support the initiative of local governance rather than they should be seen as the lead. So in that case, they will provide more opportunity for the local governance to have more reach to the people rather than they will say that, yes, this is done for me by this PRT or that PRT. So in that case, there will be the strength of PRT should be used in that way to support the local governance to be seen as the lead, but at the same time, those who are providing, who are reaching to the people, because they are also engaged through the development project for the outreach. And finally, in order to implement this, four key issues is needed. Reconciliation without the position of strength is not possible. And reconciliation without security is also, again, a very difficult issue. In order to tackle that, as the Bonn Agreement timeline has worked effectively, because everybody was focused on, for instance, the lawyer jirga, yes, we have to make it happen, we have to provide security, we have to provide all the elements that will make those targets to be met. I think the next election of Afghanistan should be targeted, although it is very difficult, it is a very different situation. As that kind of a target for improving security and bringing stability and enhancing the reconciliation effort in Afghanistan. So to do that, I think we need a kind of a temporary troop surge, but it should be temporary. We need the Afghanistan security sector reform to be accelerated, and the ceiling of the National Army should be increased. So after the temporary troop surge, those National Army units can replace the international security forces, so you will localize and Afghanize more the security, and that will help both in terms of the costing, in terms of the sensitivity. And then together with that, if we were successful in terms of building this regional consensus, then the reconciliation move forward with full speed with the reconciliation. So you will have a kind of a comprehensive approach, both with reconstruction, with reconciliation, with the military, and in that case, hopefully Afghanistan can be stable. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Masoom, for this very comprehensive overview and these very concrete recommendations, which I'm sure will spur a lot of discussion in the question and answer period. But first, I'd like to give the floor to Alex Speer. Alex.
Thanks. Thanks, everybody, for coming and waiting patiently while we expanded our presence to allow more people to join the conversation. I think it was a great overview, and I just want to make a few points and perhaps ask a few questions that Masoom and might pick up in the Q&A process. The first point that I wanted to underscore is how fundamentally complex any sort of peace process is that we might be talking about here. We're at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and a lot of what we do is focus on peace processes and how parties that are in conflict get out of conflict. This particular case presents some really dramatic obstacles to being able to do that, and I wanted to highlight some of those, and some of which Masoom has already touched on. The first is that there are regional, national, and local dimensions to this conflict, and the complexity of those alone is a lot, not only in terms of the number of groups that Masoom pointed out, but when you're talking about the regional dimensions, you're talking about the relationship with Pakistan first and foremost. You're talking about then the relationship between India and Pakistan, which in many ways informs what Pakistan does in Afghanistan. You talk about Iran, which is in some ways a lesser player in this conflict, although certainly given the presence of the United States, maintains sort of a foot on both sides of the line. And then you have other regional actors who wax and wane in terms of their interest to influence events in Afghanistan. But there is no solution in Afghanistan without the regional actors. This is something that we saw repeatedly in the 1990s with the absolutely the failure to resolve the civil war there, because essentially many of Afghanistan's neighbors and other powers as well consistently use Afghanistan as a proxy battleground. What's happening on the Afghan-Pakistan border has become even more complex, because all of these groups, which were in some ways proxies, in some ways a result of our policies from the 1980s in terms of fighting the Soviet Union's invasion and occupation of Afghanistan, have morphed and have really grown out of control. We saw that initially in the 1990s. Clearly, we saw that with the development of al-Qaeda. And now what we're seeing is that sort of cancer in the tribal areas has now grown to attack its host as well, Pakistan. And so the instability on both sides of the border, not only in terms of the insurgents themselves, but in terms of Islamabad and Kabul, have really grown. The national dimensions are also there, because in Afghanistan you still have unresolved tensions from a long civil war. You have these ethnic tensions that Masoom demonstrated or spoke about, which sort of underline some of the regional tensions. And then you have local issues. A lot of when we think about Taliban and other groups and who's doing what they're doing and why, some of this really comes to the sort of micro political climates in the Afghan-Pakistan border area. It has to do with tribal disputes and other things. And so you're dealing with an incredibly layered conflict here. And so if you want to talk about initiating a peace process, we have to be able to ask these questions you know, what do the parties want, and what can the government of Afghanistan and the international community offer them? But in order to answer that question, you really you're looking at it through a prism, because there are so many different groups, and your answer won't be the same. And I think in some ways therein lies the solution, because there is not going to be a peace accord with the Taliban. No one's going to sit down and sign an agreement. This is going to be a process of winning over allegiances of different groups for different reasons, and that's going to take a multi-layered approach. Let me make two brief comments based on that. The first is that Afghanistan, since the Bonn Agreement in 2001, has been on a trajectory. There was this agreement, which then brought in a transitional and interim administration. There was then a constitution passed in 2004, which, if you haven't read it, it's actually quite interesting, worth looking at. It's a fairly moderate, democratic, although Islamic, constitution. And that is really the frame. And then in 2004 and 2005 were the first national elections. They're going to be again, hopefully, in 2009 and 2010. This process has a frame to it, and I don't think that anybody, either in the Afghan government or in the international community, is seriously thinking about letting the process spill outside of that frame, which has some very serious implications. It means that the clause in the Constitution that says that men and women are equal is not up for negotiation. It means that the territorial boundaries of Afghanistan, it means that the current power distribution, some of these fundamental questions that exist within the Constitution, and most fundamentally, I think, the fact that it is, in fact, a moderate and Islamic democracy with a lot of rights for its citizens, is not likely to change. And so any negotiations that go forward do have to go forward within this broad framework, which does provide a lot of limitations, because obviously those parties who are now fighting the government weren't at the table or at the many tables when these different deals were conceived. And so that, combined with the fact that the presence of international forces, which is really needed to continue this the stabilization of the country, are not likely to be on the table. So that might right away take a number of the serious groups and some of the more ideological groups off the table. There's also the question of amnesty. Now, of course, the Afghan government can go a ways in terms of providing amnesty. There was an attempt last year by the parliament to provide amnesty essentially to itself, because there are a lot of warlords and former communists in the parliament who wanted to forgive themselves for their past actions, and they managed to get together to do that. But there were two important exceptions to that. One is that you can't ever, under Islam, take away the rights of the victims to pursue justice. And so that remains. You also, I think under Afghan and international law, can't take away the right of people to be prosecuted for war crimes, crimes against humanity. So again, this offer of amnesty does come with some legal hinges to it that might prevent bringing everybody inside the tent. And so the question then becomes, what can you do? And so this is one of the ways in which I want to reflect back to Masoom, this question of what is really there to offer. Certainly safety and security for people who decide to hang up their guns. Hopefully that's something you could offer, although in the current environment quite difficult. You might be able to offer some political appointments, governorships, police chiefs, that kind of thing, although certainly that has to happen. You have to consider what the impact is going to be on the local civilian population if you allow political appointments. You can allow people to compete in the political process again, as so far as they haven't committed war crimes or crimes against humanity, if there's some way to prove that. So I think that there's still this weighty question for insurgents who might be feeling some momentum at the moment based on some spectacular attacks this year, which have set the international community somewhat on its back foot. What is it that's really going to draw people in to this process? I had some other comments, but I'll leave it there and turn over to John.
Okay, thank you. John?
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here in Washington at USIP. During the introductions, you heard that I'm based full-time in the Kabul office of USIP, and living in Afghanistan full-time, I often get stuck in the day-to-day minutiae of what's happening over there and following political events and going to all of the meetings. And it's rare that I get an opportunity like this to step back and put things in greater perspective and think about the big picture. And I think Masoom really did a good job in encapsulating a lot of the key issues related to stabilizing Afghanistan and addressing reconciliation effectively. So I'll be quite brief in my remarks, as a lot of it would just be repeating what Masoom said. And that said, I also just want to say it's a pleasure to be here on the panel with Masoom, whom I've never had the opportunity to meet until today, although his name is quite prominent in the Afghan government. And I have a message to pass on to him from President Karzai, which is get back soon. And you're needed over there. But anyway, I'll be brief, as I said. And thinking about stability in Afghanistan, there are a couple of things that I would just want to reiterate that we heard from Masoom. And one of those is that unless we address things regionally, that is, looking at safe havens in Pakistan, there is not going to be stability in Afghanistan. We can't look at this solely through the lens of what's happening inside the borders of Afghanistan. It has to be addressed in a cross-border manner. The second point would be that without reconciliation, there will be no stability in Afghanistan as well. And that sort of ties into the first point, because without addressing Pakistan, there won't be reconciliation. Masoom nicely summarized some of the key facets and what a reconciliation process might look like and some of the concerns and problems that we have in trying to structure a reconciliation program. And I'm just going to highlight six of those for you now, very briefly, and then turn it over, as I think we're wrapping up at 3:30, so we'll try to leave as much room for Q&A as possible. I guess when speaking about reconciliation, the first question that we should ask is, well, what is reconciliation? What do we mean by reconciliation? I mean, the word gets tossed around a lot in Afghanistan, in policy circles, in discussions that we have at the UN and in donor communities and with the with Afghan government officials, but I don't think anybody really has ever come up with a proper definition for what reconciliation means. And unless we actually know what we're talking about when we're using that term, often people will be talking over each other and not really understanding exactly what it is that they're discussing. Now, today, I'm not going to try to come up with a definition of it for you, but just in the few comments that I make, I mean we're talking about primarily how to end the insurgency and bring people who are fighting into the fold in one manner or another. And of course, that comes with a number of problems. The first of which I would say is it's very difficult, as Masoom noted, to know who's speaking on behalf of the Taliban when you're entering negotiations. For that matter, it's difficult to know who's speaking on behalf of the government, because you'll have various government programs, including PTS, led by Moshe Dede in the Upper House of Parliament, that was set up 3 years ago to address reconciliation matters and amnesty issues. But speaking with various people in the government, it seems like half the cabinet in Afghanistan has their own reconciliation program, and a number of members of parliament are running their own as well. Ibrahim Gailani is one of the more prominent ones, who's offered up his own version of reconciliation. There's a lot of competition among Afghan government officials as to who should be actually leading the reconciliation charge, and that opens up a lot of questions in the insurgents' eyes as to who they should be dealing with, and you also wind up seeing some reconciliation forum shopping often on behalf of some of the insurgents. The second problem would be who are we reconciling? Again, this ties in with who are we talking to. But also, how do we differentiate among different levels of Taliban fighters? I mean, there are the low-level people with the Kalashnikov who are just trying to protect their land and are fearful of people of the Taliban leadership and so fall into line. And then there are the hard-line leaders of the Taliban, and they're quite different. And the way that people approach them through reconciliation programs needs to be considered. There are at least, I could think of, four different levels to differentiate between these people. At one end of the spectrum would be the hardcore, irreconcilable people that we have to go after and imprison or worse in any instance that is possible. Then there are those who could possibly be reconciled with tough threats of strict criminal action being brought against them if they're caught and trying to sort of use the harsh penalties as a threat to try to bring them into the government fold. That obviously isn't going to work right now with the lack of rule of law in the country, but it's one category that you might want to consider of people. And then there are those with whom you might just use some incentives and people who are more sitting on the fence, trying to bring them in and back to trust the government more. And then finally, there would even be those, I think, who would start claiming to be Taliban, who actually aren't Taliban, just so that they could take advantage of whatever reconciliation incentives might be out there. A third problem would be who should be taking the lead on this. I think Alex touched on this a bit. There really is no Afghan government entity right now who's capable of effectively leading a reconciliation process, and arguably perhaps there shouldn't be. Perhaps there should be some sort of more neutral outside body that's taking the lead to try to come up with a reconciliation program and bringing parties together for talks, which, you know, some might say, well, should that be some international body, and who in the international community has any credibility on both sides in Afghanistan right now? Those obviously are important questions to address, and I won't attempt to answer them here. Fifth problem, I would say, would be that there's a lack of coordinated international support for this. Not that there's a lack of international support, but that it's not coordinated. There have been a number of programs by the PRTs, by ISAF, the British military have had their own sort of amnesty-type program down in Helmand province in the past. The United States has a certain approach that it takes to reconciliation that differs greatly from some of our European allies. And without a coordinated international approach to this, again, it raises questions as to who's speaking for whom and how best to address this and what sort of leverage the international community can bring to the Afghan government if they're not speaking with a concerted voice. A fourth or fifth problem, I've lost track, is that the state itself in Afghanistan right now really has no leverage. If you're on the Taliban side of things, either in the Pakistan side of the border or in the south and part of the insurgency, what's in it for you to go join, put down your arms and join the state right now? The state's not providing services in much of the country, and all they're saying right now, or that they've said in the past generally, is you'll get amnesty from prosecution if you come join us. And, you know, in DDR, I suppose they promised them some sort of reintegration type programs that were relatively successful but left a lot to be offered. So I think right now there's not very much incentive for the Taliban to give up the fight, and the state needs to consolidate its control and have something more that it can offer so that it has the leverage that it can use to have an effective reconciliation program. And then lastly, of course, goes back to what I started with, which is Pakistan. You can have the most effective reconciliation structure in Afghanistan and have the government speaking with one concerted voice and the international community on board, but unless you're talking to the masters across the border in Pakistan who are actually leading the insurgency, it's going to be ineffective. So there has to be some sort of mechanism to address the cross-border aspect of this. And I'll stop there for now because there's only about 20 minutes left. Open it up.
Okay. Thanks very much, John. I would like to open it up to the floor. There's a microphone up here, so please come forward here to the microphone. Identify yourself. Please try to keep your comment and question brief, and we'll take a few at the same time. Come back here and then come back to the room. So please.
George D'Angelo with Conflict Solutions International. I have a question for any of the panelists. Do we know exactly who's financing the Taliban and related groups? Is there anybody tracking the financial movements that allow Taliban to build up his forces in the struggle? So just a basic question. Thanks.
Okay, thanks. Please.
Well, my name is Stacey Faust. I'm from Checking Company Consulting. Prosecution was mentioned a couple times. I wanted to know if anyone on the panel could expand on the role that the judicial system could play in a reconciliation process or gaining justice for the victims, and if you think that the justice system is ready to take on that role or what changes it needs to see within the justice system to do that.
Okay, thanks. Okay. We'll take one more.
There was a hint of an idea of investing more in the party process in Afghanistan. In other words, investing and somehow making the party process work better. There was a hint of what, and I would like to know what that would be, whether that was a national program. Just one more thing. Can we work out this problem in Afghanistan without putting the kind of resources into peace negotiations between India and Pakistan that we've put into, say, the Irish conflict or the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? I mean, as long as they're getting F-16s from us supposedly to fight terrorism, is this ever going to stop? Are they ever going to let Afghanistan be Afghanistan?
Did you identify yourself?
I'm sorry. My name is Philip Munger.
Thank you. Let's start it off. Maybe Masoom, and then I'm sure Alex and John want to jump in. Masoom.
Thank you for the comments and some of the issues I didn't mention and because of the time already I took too much time, but some of the issue are addressed in the report in the framework as you mentioned as a problem and how they should be addressed within the government and also at the international community in terms of a common point of contact in Afghanistan side and what should be dealt in the Pakistan side. Regarding the tracking of the financing of the Taliban, yes, there are information about their resources. The recent UN report is saying that $100 million they are getting from the narco trade and the narco business. That is one source. The other source, there are a lot of money is coming from the different Gulf countries as well, and from individual they are pouring there. There are indirect, informal, but somehow linked to the state-sponsored support in a different way that is coming, but they are not tracked properly. And because they are in an area, most of them are using this money from the hawala system. I don't know here this hawala system is operating or not, but that is extremely difficult to track the financing mechanism. And this is why I said that there are UN resolution. They are mentioning these issues that the financing, the support, and the sanctuary of those terrorists in Taliban should be properly tracked and followed and reported. As you know, that there is no a proper mechanism for enforcement, those implementation of those resolution. So that is the kind of a situation they are getting a lot of resources from that. I will leave the judiciary question to Alex. He will deal with that.
Well, I'm actually going to punt further. I'll let John handle the prosecution question. I'm just going to say something about the political party question. Because I do think it's very important. The Afghan democratic process is gravely hindered by the absence of good political party system. And this really has two foundations. One is that there's grave mistrust on the part of many Afghans for political parties, because the history of political parties in Afghanistan have been one of extremes that led to the problems in the 1970s with the communist coup, then led to the civil war, and then the Mujahideen government during the civil war. Parties have often been associated with extremism and with essentially illegal armed groups. And so people hear that term and they get very anxious about it. President Karzai is one of those people who is very anxious about it, and so they devised an electoral system in Afghanistan, which is one of the most unusual and most unfortunate electoral systems that exists in the world, that is essentially an anti-party electoral system. And the problem with that is that there is no functioning democracy without political parties. You need political parties for a variety of reasons, but most importantly, you need them to govern, to build coalitions, to engage in parliamentary politics. You need them to mitigate the extremes by having parties that occupy the center. And because, for the reasons that Masoom said, that Afghanistan does not have political parties that are not based on a person or on ethnicity, you have this problem that there's nowhere for all of the political energies to go. And so they tend to go into the extremes where people do organize parties, like the Taliban, or like the Communist Party in the 1970s, and then they get arms to fight the political system that doesn't accommodate them. And so the political system in Afghanistan and stability overall would be much better served by a party system and an electoral system that encourages moderation through the development of parties that are based not on ethnicity or extremism, but on the basic sort of ideology that most political systems differentiate themselves on.
John, do you want to say something about prostitution?
Sure.
Everybody's pushing that question to you.
It was a two-part question, one being could the prosecution office and the judiciary play a role in any reconciliation process? And I think, yes, it certainly could play a role if it was functioning effectively. And certainly I think reconciliation is going to need to be a basket of carrots and sticks, and one of the sticks could be a threat of prosecution. A threat of being brought before a court and convicted of crimes. And that could very well lead people to put down their arms and come in to the government fold for whatever reason, if they have a promise of amnesty or if there's some other means of transitional justice put forward. The second part of the question is, I guess, related to the first, is the judicial system ready to do this? And the answer is no. It's right now the state justice system is very weak. It doesn't extend into most of the country, and where it does, it's viewed largely as corrupt, inefficient. It's staffed by poorly trained lawyers and judges. Who lack resources, physical resources, material resources, copies of the law, and people are likely not to want to go through the state justice system to resolve their disputes. That said, Afghanistan has a long history of traditional dispute resolution that certainly could play a role in any reconciliation process. And in fact, it has in recent years, as you know, some of the high-profile jirgas that you've seen are just representative of what's a common dispute resolution mechanism in the country, where communities will often have elders sit together to resolve disputes among members of the community and try to come up with some sort of reconciliation of the dispute and have the parties agree to a compromise outcome. So I think replicating something like that could certainly be a useful mechanism for a reconciliation process in the country.
Okay, let's go for second round.
Thank you. My name is Bridget. I'm from the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Sir, you invoke the pronoun we frequently in your speech. We need to pursue this model of reconciliation. But what I'm hearing from the two discussants' comments is that the United States, as a unilateral actor, would have a reputation that's already a bit tarnished in such an endeavor. Pakistan is too self-interested, and the Afghan central government is either too corrupt, too dysfunctional, or too ill-equipped to be the we. And so my question for you is, who do you see as being the we that you have referred to so frequently?
My name is Ahmar Masti Khan, and I'm a freelance journalist. My question is directed to Mr. John Dempsey, since he has freshly arrived from Kabul. I would like to ask, you see, the Baluch and Pashtuns have historically and traditionally been allies of Afghanistan. Do you think the Balkanization, peaceful Balkanization of Pakistan, offers a viable solution to the Afghan problem?
Good afternoon. My name is Jawan Sheikh. I'm originally from Afghanistan, but I'm working now for Hudson Institute Center on Islam and Democracy and Future of the Muslim World. I think it's very important sometimes if we don't speak the facts, we ignore our rights for our people and for our country. And what I'm wondering is we have peace and we have security in the west and north part of the country, but unfortunately, we don't have any development or real institutions in those parts of the country, then why we make ourselves too much busy to go into like areas where there's war, but we didn't do our own job in those two real areas that we have the chance to go and work for the people. And there people are now uprising against everything. And second thing, we talked about the frame of reconciliation, as John explained it. What is this reconciliation? And we don't need a reconciliation if we can achieve it. If we cannot cross a river, we can just stay aside. We don't need to cross that river. My point is here, today either we accept or not accept, there are differences in Afghanistan. We just had it last week. A leader of a political party, he kind of refused the rights of a great king of Afghanistan, unfortunately. But anyway, I don't want to go for that. Did we really make... And we, Afghanistan is a tribal society, and Masumi Saib, he pointed out on the district levels as they pressured those warlords to disarm themselves, and at the same time, he emphasized on the community capacity. Like, if we gave the chance for the locals, they do their job. Isn't it necessary for today to go with the decentralization of the country? Why not? If we don't have a strong central government, then we can go with a decentralization, and we gave the rights for the people in the south to choose their own governor, we gave the rights for the people in the east to choose their governance. What is the problem there? And okay, that was it. Thank you.
Let's take one more, and then we'll take a third round afterwards.
Mayim Sabri, also from the Hudson Institute Center for Islam, Democracy, and the Future of the Muslim World. Mr. Dempsey talked about reconciliation and how important it is. I'm originally from Pakistan, so just on an Afghan Pak level, a really important part of reconciliation is acknowledgement, and we see very little acknowledgement from the Pakistani administration about the Pakistani states and the ISI's role in setting up the Taliban. I'm just wondering, with this recent development where apparently the ISI is now under civilian control, assuming that this is not just symbolic because of Prime Minister Gilani's trip to the United States, how do you think that dynamic is going to play out, considering that the ISI has such a strong role in setting up the Taliban?
Yeah, the first question that about whom I am talking, that we, as I said, that there should be a double compact, a compact. There is a compact between Afghanistan and the international community. They are working for the same purpose of stability and to make the world more secure. And Afghanistan is working for that Afghanistan to be secure. So when I'm talking about the Afghan government by themselves, it will not be able to do it. The international, if they feel that they are doing it without the Afghans, they will not be able to do it. When I'm saying we, if we are tying our collective strength, I think we will be able to do it. If we're not, and we go into the same blame game, I don't think we will be able to achieve that. The overall objective and goal of stability and security in the region in Afghanistan. But together, I think we will be able to make it. It is difficult. There are challenges in the Afghanistan government side. There are challenges in the international community side. Afghanistan should also recognize that they need the support of the international. But at the same time, we have to think about our own problem inside the country and to fix those things that we are able to fix it. If we go with this current status quo, we will not be achieving anything. We have to fix them, and we have to realize that. And the same thing, the international should also recognize that ignorance and continuing the policy of unilateral and to say to impose, that will not also work. Because it will create other symptoms. So the most important, I'm focusing and stressing on the collective efforts for stabilizing Afghanistan at the regional level, at the international level, and at the national level in Afghanistan. The issue of the ISI, that whether it is symbolic or not, the time will tell us that what will be the situation, because shifting an organization from one organization to another, I don't think it will change the nature. But if they really come under the civilian government control, under the democratic control, I think it will have an impact. But it will take time. In Pakistan, the civil government is trying to consolidate its power and its authority. In the Pakistan, there are struggles ongoing. There is a gap of some kind of vacuum of the power with whom you are talking, and the next day somebody else will talk on in a different language. But this is a positive moment. If I believe strongly, if Pakistan change its policy toward Afghanistan sincerely, and Afghanistan and Pakistan work together, I don't think it will be a very significant problem. This problem can be addressed. There is debt, there is, they are very serious, but it can be addressed and it is possible. But it, the only issue is if we can do it. The other colleagues asked about there are peace in one part of the country and there are problem in other part of the country. I think we should look at Afghanistan as a unit. Because if one part is destabilized, it will have its impact on the other side, because the smuggling, the weapon trade, the influence of insecurity, they will impact one part to another part of the country. But yes, I agree that we have to emphasize on building the local capacity so that the Afghan can participate actively in the security, in the development, I do agree in some instances we didn't pay enough attention to areas where we could do more development, where there was the situation was more prevailing and conducive to do that. But at the same time, doing all the development at once, it is extremely difficult. Sometimes people are perceiving, because this is an issue of expectation in Afghanistan. It was such a high expectation of the international community that Afghanistan will be the best country in 5-6 years. I think that was a kind of a false expectation. We were not able to manage those expectations. But if you look to the volume of work is being done in Afghanistan, I think during the past 50 years, we were not able to do that amount of infrastructure, schools or clinics or things like that. So there are something is done, but basically we are still on the asset distribution side. We are not at the stage of wealth creation in Afghanistan to create sustainable jobs for people.
Do you want to add something?
Yeah, I just want to say something briefly on this point about the decentralization, because I think it's very important. Afghanistan has never had a extremely strong centralized state, but it has had a state that could do certain things well. And at the same time, it has a very decentralized nature, both politically, geographically. And so we need to marry these things. Clearly, you need a state in Afghanistan that can control its borders and that can impose some sort of generalized monopoly on the use of violence. But at the same time, when you look at the capacity of Afghan communities to contribute to their own governance and development, to work on justice things such as what John discussed before, to work on small-scale local development initiatives, to work on health and education initiatives, it's very strong. And in fact, it's much, much stronger than what the government capacity in the center currently is or is likely to be anytime soon. And so we need to marry these two goals together. We need to focus on the critical elements that cannot be devolved well or effectively to the local area and build that capacity in Kabul, while at the same time decentralizing some of the things that Afghans in their communities can really do better than what the government can do now or is likely to do in the near future. And I think that that's a really critical balance that we need to achieve, and we need to be aware of in terms of programming in the country.
Okay, thank you. Let's go to the last round here, please.
I'm Jim Jones. I'm former counter-narcotics advisor for the UN for the Andes, with some very, very modest experience in Afghanistan, okay, with a lot of questions, and sometimes I try to compare the regions. When I was in Afghanistan last year with the UN, I was impressed with the amount of money that's going into the country, first off, from the international community. I was also impressed with the chaos, okay, and the large number of actors that were operating in the country. And I guess in theory, you assume addressed challenges and opportunities at the top and the bottom, okay, but at the very top, the international community, I'm having a lot of trouble seeing how coordination can be improved. UNAMA is weak. I mean, we found that there's a lot of things they couldn't do. In theory, UNAMA would be the force that would could improve coordination. It's not doing it. So what, do you have any thoughts on this? I mean, what could you tell us about that?
Okay. Thank you. Please.
I'm Raghubir Goel from India Globe and Asia Today. Since Pakistan is a master and is a hub of terrorism, and now Pakistani Prime Minister is here, he met with President Bush yesterday in the White House, and today is meeting with Defense Secretary and many other cabinet minister members. What message do you have for him as far as he is saying that Pakistan is not the problem? I met him yesterday at the White House.
Okay.
To the first question, I think from my point of view, the solution for the coordination is a functional state and institutions. And based on the state, to have a more functional state and institution that will provide an opportunity for effective coordination. If you don't have the local leadership, whatever money and resources is coming, you will not know where these resources are spent. Second, budget is the best tool for coordinating the resources that is coming, where they are spent, and you can be responsible and accountable for that. If you do that, that is the real solution for any coordination challenge and problem. Coming to the second question, that what will be my message to that, I think my message is very clear. First, I ask everybody, please don't fight your disputes on Afghanistan soil. Anybody, any country, any regional country, because Afghanistan has become a battleground for different countries. So they have to solve their dispute by their own. The second is, if they want stability and security in Pakistan, it is in their interest, and it is in the interest of Afghanistan people, that they should work together and closely. Instead of denial, we have to acknowledge there are problems. And then to address this problem, we have to work together. And I forgot one thing, that yes, if we can transform the border area between the two countries into a free economic zone rather than into a free militia zone, then that will be the real solution for the long-term security. And I think there are debate about the reconstruction opportunity zone. There are the debate on the G8 about that, how to improve the situation, investment, and to de-radicalize the situation and to address the poverty. And that is really the issue that we have to address. And my message to the international community would be that bring Pakistan, India, Afghanistan on the same table, rather than they accuse each other of having influence in Afghanistan, and have a very frank discussion among themselves, and to say that, yes, to provide them with a kind of a guarantee that the Afghanistan or India or Pakistan will not be against the third country. So that will be the real kind of a trust building.
Okay, thank you. Alex or John, do you have any concluding thoughts?
Go ahead first.
We did actually skip one question. I'll just address quite quickly where I'm not sure if he's still here, who asked about, okay, back there, asked me what I thought the prospects were for peaceful balkanization of Pakistan, and perhaps that being a solution. I think peaceful balkanization sounds like an oxymoron to me, and I don't think that in the Pakistan context it would be very peaceful either. I don't think the Punjabis or the Sindh are going to see a peaceful division of Pakistan anytime soon. So I wouldn't see that as a viable solution. I catch the gist of your question as to this being a largely Islamabad-led problem, where Islamabad is looking towards its neighbor to the east, India, and Afghanistan is simply a tactical battleground in its greater conflict with India. And so Afghanistan becomes important for Pakistan in terms of strategic depth and the various arguments that we hear repeatedly. But that said, just to go back to your original question, I don't think that that's a viable solution right now.
I just want to say that a lot has been said about this issue with Pakistan, and I think that it's very important for us to remember. I was in Pakistan for the elections in February, and they really were historic elections. I mean, Pakistan has been under a military dictatorship for the last 8 years, and for more than 50% of their last 50-plus years of existence, 60 years of existence. And I think it's very important for us to give some space to the new civilian government to try and get on its feet. They are sending a lot of the right messages across the border. Before Prime Minister Gilani left, Pakistan. He said that the fight against extremism is Pakistan's fight. This is not somebody else's fight. I lost my leader, of course, Benazir Bhutto, in that fight. And I think that making these statements boldly and repeatedly, as he has done, is sending a signal. Now, the problem is that the military assets of Pakistan, the ISI assets of Pakistan, are not under civilian control, nor should we expect them to be a few months after the end of the military dictatorship, nor, frankly, have they really ever been in Pakistan's history. And so there is a process of evolution that needs to happen in Pakistan in order for it to become a credible partner of Afghanistan and the United States in dealing with what is really, truly a common security question. But the fact that the Pakistani senior civilian leadership, I think, is starting not only to say that, but to feel it, is a sign that at least things will potentially move in the right direction. But they're going to need a tremendous amount of support to do that. And I believe that enhancing the current Afghan-Pakistan relationship, which really could do nothing but enhance because it's been so bad, is really one of the key elements of that. And I think that it's something that we need to work on very hard. And I do think that this is where, going back to that previous question that I think we ignored, the United States has a critical role in the region because we are allies of Afghanistan, we are allies of Pakistan, we are allies of India. And there's not really too many others that can say that. And I think that we are credibly allies of all of those governments, and we need to figure out a regional solution so that everybody's security interests are taken into account in order to address Afghanistan's problems ultimately.
Can I just quickly ask you what role India is playing now, and what do you want India to play a role?
India is playing, for instance, one of the biggest, one of the largest donors to Afghanistan in terms of the reconstruction efforts in Afghanistan. And that kind of Pakistan is perceiving a kind of influence, increasing influence of India in Afghanistan. As I said, that there are a different perception of influence in Afghanistan. Afghanistan, from India perspective, I think they want to see a strong Afghanistan. In more developed and stable, so that the soil will not be used as a place for the training of the terrorists. On the other hand, Pakistan see a threat of increasing role of the India in Afghanistan, and they feel that they will be a kind of a security threat for them, and they want to see a weak state and to be prepared for the day if the NATO and the US leave Afghanistan, and they should be prepared for something.
On that note, I would say stay tuned. USIP has a number of projects dealing with all the different dimensions of the conflict in Afghanistan. Thank you for coming, and please join me in thanking Masoom Samekdai and HP.
And some of the publications that Chantal mentioned have actually been put outside on the table if anybody wants to pick those up on the way out.